welcome to the program. It's great to have you. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Francis. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've been trying to work this out for a long time, and it's good to have you here to talk about some of the issues that your, I guess, former counterparts in government are dealing with. This is a pretty challenging time for CIOs. People are expected to do more with less, or to do more with nothing in some cases, and figure out solutions to problems. As you go and talk in your role with General Dynamics to the people that used to do the same thing, or that are doing now the same thing that you used to do, running IT shops at agencies, what are they telling you kind of secretly or privately that is bothering them or that is making their job more difficult?
Well, I think the biggest challenge for most of my colleagues who are still in government services is trying to find ways to leverage the resources they have and to keep up with the constantly evolving technology.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say second to that would be staying on top of the security issues. I think security is a challenge for everyone, both in and out of the government.
Melissa Hathaway was on the show last week talking about there are, I think, 51 pieces of legislation on Capitol Hill now that deal with cybersecurity. There are only a couple that she cited as being likely to pass anytime soon. But that adds, I imagine, a tremendous level of uncertainty to what people have to do, what people are trying to do, because you don't know what your next step when it comes to a certification or any of these issues is going to be.
Well, we use government protocols and government standards very heavily as policy within our own company.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to complying with these policies as we deliver services and goods to our customers, that's actually how we choose architecture. That's how we choose solutions that we implement for doing our own business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest challenge there really is that the threat itself is constantly changing, and the threat is very sophisticated. And so you have to be very thoughtful about how you invest in your security portfolio going forward, because it's a very complex balancing act. It's about people. You've got to have trained, skilled people who know how to detect a threat, how to contain it once it's detected, how to correct the system so that it isn't vulnerable in that way again, to try to develop solutions that that can avoid the threat in the first place. It's about the solutions themselves, and the technology is constantly evolving. And so you have to be prepared to spend the effort to follow where these products and where these technologies are headed. And then, of course, you got to balance that against your financial resources that you have available, because security is just a piece of it. And I mean, the real name of the game is to do the mission of your organization, whatever that is. And
mm-hmm.
So applications and the infrastructure that those applications need to operate on all have to get balanced out at the end of the day. And so that's a real challenge for a CIO.
The CIOs are likely going to be woven more tightly into the structures of these organizations. One of the things that a lot of CIOs have told me is that a lot of the other leaders in the C-suite at the agencies are still kind of working on a late 20th century model, which is the CIO is the person you call when your BlackBerry doesn't work, and not so much when it's time to make a policy about how your agency operates and so on. We have this tremendously high level of technology woven into the day-to-day life of the agencies, and yet the CIOs sometimes still, in 2010, not at the table when operational decisions are made.
I think that's true. But I also think that it's a big part of the CIO's job to take that on as a personal challenge to deal with. You've got to make yourself relevant. No
mm-hmm.
one else can really do that for you. It helps when the head of the agency or the head of the organization comes equipped with a value for IT. But where that doesn't happen, you've got to make the case for why you've got to be part of the decision process. And the reason I think that's so important is that there are so many competing demands for your time and your resources that you've got to make the right trade-offs as you go. And again, as I said, at the end of the day, it's all about providing mission support while you do these other things too. You've got to worry about the security. You've got to worry about data privacy, all these other things that, that are part of the equation. But for you to make those trade-offs well, you've really got to have a very good sense of what your organization's operational goals are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no real way to do that unless you're part of the conversation. So I don't think it's so much about status being at the table.
Right.
It's about understanding where the organization is headed and what the evolving requirements are that you can then enable with new applications of technology,
mm-hmm.
and then try to have a good sense of what the priorities are and what the timing is, and then you build that into your own planning so that the way you deliver new technology aligns closely with the needs of the organization. So you really do need to be very heavily involved in the operational part of the organization.
Are the other leaders at the agencies, do you think, getting the idea that the CIO needs to be part of each of these conversations and not just brought in at the end?
Well, from what we all hear and read, I think that varies from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
I think some organizations it's clear that the CIO is at the table, and in other places, I think they're still trying to get there.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I talked about with Melissa is the idea that there are, just like there are some leadership organizations that are not comfortable yet with that relationship, there are some CIOs that aren't maybe comfortable with that and aren't used to that. And as some of these potential pieces of legislation pass and require the CIOs to be more able and ready to step into that kind of a leadership and decision-making role, there'll be some training and so on necessary for some CIOs to step up to that level. Do you think that's true? Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, and partially because I think the role of the CIO is continuing to evolve. It's not a static role either. And by that, I mean, as we look at, as the pendulum swings back and forth on the popularity of outsourcing, as we get into conversations about cloud computing, which in on one level is another flavor of outsourcing, and another way you can look at cloud computing as a way to do consolidation,
mm-hmm.
If you're implementing a private cloud within an organization. These fundamentally change the delivery model for the information technology itself, and it changes the role of the IT organization, which the CIO leads. So, I think what happens here is the CIO really can't hang their hat any longer on being the technical guru. You certainly have to understand the technology enough to understand its capabilities and make the trade-offs and all those things, but it's far more about understanding how technology enables the mission of the organization. It's far more about management issues. It's far more about portfolio management and economics and cost analysis and business case.
Mm-hmm.
And these are not traditionally the kinds of things that a career IT person spends a lot of time developing along the way. It starts to sound more like an MBA.
Right.
So, I think the role of CIO is becoming more business-like and more operational.
Mm-hmm.
And successful CIOs going forward are going to have to adapt, and they're going to have to evolve along those lines, I think, to stay relevant.
Are we at a transformational time in the role of the CIO in that these changes are happening, but then we'll settle into a kind of a static, more static role for the CIO? Or is this, do you think, from here on out, a constantly evolving situation where your job will be different every year, completely different, maybe not completely, but noticeably, dramatically different than it was the year before?
Well, my sense is the role of a CIO will evolve much like you see technology evolve. It's not that it changes every day, but it evolves to a point and then it levels off. It becomes static for a while,
mm-hmm.
settles in, and then the next new thing happens and, you take the next step. So it kind of moves through time, plateaus and then changes and plateaus and then changes. So it's much like you see major technologies evolve. Some people actually are predicting that the CIO's role will go away. I don't subscribe to that. What I do believe, though, is that the role will evolve as we've described. I think it already has become less technical by mm-hmm. and large, And I think it will be viewed more as a executive management role, which is why I think it's important that the CIO find ways to be part of the operational decision-making process, be part of the strategy development, because to be effective in marshaling those resources and making sure that they're supporting and aligned with what the organization's doing, you really have to pay more attention to that relationship building and really being perceived as a peer in the operational part of the organization than just the technical support guy.
Mm-hmm. What as these roles change and these roles evolve and the role of the CIO changes, we may give off the impression that the role of the CISO will be the same and so on. We're not talking about that, the steps below. What kind of people will these new CIOs, the CIO of the future, if you want to put a buzz tag on it, what will he or she be looking for in team members?
Well, you know, that's an interesting observation, because I think CSIOs, SIOs, whatever level, whatever part of that job they play, are coming into their own. They've got their own magazines now. It's become a very formal profession, a lot of focus on training and certifications. But from my perspective, I think that role is evolving as well, because I think the system security folks, the information assurance folks have developed a bum rap, really, for the folks who say no. I mean, they're always the enforcer. They're the guy to go around and stop things.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't work over the long run either, because whether you're a business or whether you're a government agency, you know, you've got a job to do. And so the real role is to help the operational folks figure out how to get done what they're paid to do in a way that's as secure as possible. But again, it's a trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really more about understanding how you can apply principles of security, apply hardening to those solutions that you use to implement your business in ways that achieve a balance. They can't be rigid, and they can't be static. They have to evolve with the threat. They have to evolve with the technology. They have to evolve with the purpose of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in those roles, I think folks have to develop a stronger sense of the business and the operational priorities, in addition to their special skills that they have as a security professional, for example.
A lot of people would say those reputations of being the no people were very well deserved, because the mentality behind a lot of those no's seemed to be, we don't want to take that risk, when in many cases a lot of these things that people wanted to do were specifically designed to help these agencies meet their missions.
Well, that's true, and I think, you know, if you don't include those folks in the process, in the decision-making process, if you don't include them as part of the operational conversation that's going on, then the safest thing for them to do is say no,
mm-hmm.
because they aren't getting any direction or guidance from the operational side. And so I think it's easier for them to make a balanced decision if they're part of a conversation that is about, you know, what our organizational objectives are, what are the priorities of the business or the agency. And then you can achieve a better trade-off than if you're trying to do that on your own as a specialist in the back office.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important for all of these professional specialties to really be viewed as part of the team and part of the operational discussion, and not folks who are kind of off in the corner doing their thing.
Mm-hmm.
It works a lot better when you can achieve that.
We've talked about a couple of things that are kind of buzzwords in the IT community right now. We've talked about cloud computing. We've talked about cybersecurity. And we'll dig into each one of those items. But is there a risk that as CIOs are trying to transition out of the role that they've held, that we've talked about, into this newer situation, that with this kind of plethora of buzzwords that they'll be known as the whatever blank guy, the cybersecurity guy, or the whatever guy, instead of this new person that we're talking about.
Yeah, I personally don't get too wrapped up in the terminology, because I think a lot of it is hard to wrap anything around. I mean, cloud computing has probably done more disservice to the concept than anything.
You mean the name, cloud computing?
The name. Yeah. We spent 2 years arguing about what it was instead of how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of these labels about these functions, you know, could fall into the same thing. I personally, off the top of my head, can't think of a better title for these functions. But I think what's important is an agreement or not that you believe that these functions really need to be integrated into the way an organization operates, and that they're part of the decision-making process, they're consulted, their input is considered, and that they've got an opportunity to really understand where the organization's trying to go and how they can help enable that,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to restrict it or confine it in some way.
Let's stay on cloud computing for a couple of minutes. I have to agree with you, and you're not the first person to say, that it's the worst name in the history of information technology. You didn't say that, but people have said that. I can't imagine personally why anybody would listen to an argument for putting their stuff in the cloud, where it sounds so ethereal, like you don't know if it's going to disappear or something like that.
Right.
Are we past that stage, do you think? Do you think most IT leaders and others in government who are decision makers understand the benefits of at least private clouds?
I think so. I mean, you don't hear people arguing much anymore about what is cloud.
Mm-hmm.
People are starting to coin some what I think are better labels, like real-time infrastructure and things like that, that are a little more descriptive. But I do see people really trying to understand how to use it. I think we lost some ground early on in the discussion, because particularly when you're talking about the government as the client set that you're trying to support, you're trying to understand what their issues and concerns and needs are, they're largely around the security piece of it. Is how are you going to convince me that you're going to protect my information while it's in transit from where I've got it to where you're going to store it or process it or handle it for me? How are you going to protect it on its way back? How are you going to protect it while it's there? By the way, if I decide to change service providers, how are you going to assure me that there's not residual intellectual property or sensitive data on your devices? Those are important discussions, and putting it into the cloud really, you know, slows you down.
Yeah.
That's not what you want to hear.
No.
You want to know where it's at, who's got it. And when you look at some of the disciplined, checklists that have evolved over the past year or so to help people think through the process of, okay, what makes sense for me to put into the cloud? Who should I do business with? How do I decide that they're really living up to the commitments they made? These checklists really are all about those things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a government client, you're much more demanding than many commercial clients are, in terms of, I don't want my data commingled. I want to know physically where it's at. I want to know physically who's got access to it. I want to see your security capabilities. Those are all part of the decision process. But I think we're past that. And so, particularly if you look at government agencies that are starting to use cloud computing, they're starting a step at a time. They're putting things there that are, for example, about communications.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the purpose is to get information out to folks. So the threat or the risk of that getting lost or someplace it shouldn't be is pretty low. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you want it out there.
Right.
Other things where there's a high content of personal or private information, where the information may be secure, I think that's going to be a long time coming. What we're seeing with our clients, particularly government clients, is much more interest in us helping them design and implement private clouds, which they can continue to control than moving a lot of sensitive information out into a third party's infrastructure.
Yeah. Where did that come from? It seemed like we went through this period of time for, as you said, 2 years or so, where people talked about cloud computing and weren't really sure what they wanted to do and weren't sure if they were comfortable with the security. And then I bet you within 2 months, I talked to 4 or 5 agency CIOs that were saying, we're pretty much set that we're doing a private cloud. And it went from, I have no idea what to do, and I might not know for 2 years, to boom, like that, this is what we're going to do.
Well, I think the benefits of a private cloud for a government customer is that it really is an effective way to increase efficiency and to reduce operating costs in an environment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you have to be careful of is that you don't rush to judgment there, because it's about a lot more than just the technology, because there's change management, there's getting people bought into the notion of doing it. And again, as a prior government CIO, I tend not to see these conversations so much as being about control, which is how we tend to label it. I tend to see it more as about accountability, which I felt very strongly, and I think many of my colleagues who are still in government service, that's their issue, is mm-hmm. if I'm accountable for this, I want to be sure that it's in good hands, it's being done properly, and I feel better about that if I'm doing it myself.
Yeah.
But what's happened is, I think as this conversation is unfolded, people are starting to get comfortable with the notion that you can control this. I mean, in large measure, many of these technologies that comprise cloud computing really aren't brand new. They've been around a while. There are some new products that are part of the natural technology evolution, but this really is a different delivery model, mm-hmm. is what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And it's about being scalable. It's about pricing it differently. And so with a private cloud, you're not involving a third party. You're still doing it yourself. So the big challenge is to convince the components who may have been able to do that themselves in the past, is that they are now going to be able to participate in a consolidated shared service in a way that is going to be cost effective. It's going to be reliable. And it's going to allow them to remain accountable for the things that they're responsible for. And I think people are getting to the point where that makes sense now.
Mm-hmm.
So you see people trying it.
You mentioned scalability. It seems to me that's the biggest. You said some of this technology is been around for a while, but the scalability piece of it seems to be the biggest difference between what people have tried before and what they're doing now, because it doesn't, my outside observation as a non-expert is, until some of the technologies that people have been able to use over the last couple of years manifested themselves, you didn't have the wide variances in the need for scalability that you have now.
Right. I think there are two major benefits for cloud computing, and scalability is one of them. This notion of being able to turn a capacity to do something on and off at will and to just pay for what you use is very attractive to folks,
mm-hmm.
because more traditional approaches to providing IT is you went out and bought the device and you parked it somewhere and you plugged it in and you were paying for it whether you used it or not. And if you could find somebody to share it with, that was fine. But if not, you know, it was kind of a fixed sunk cost.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas cloud computing, if you can get a big enough population of users in there and willing to participate in the shared environment, you can turn things on and off. And it makes a lot of sense for like a communication program where you got a message you want to get out and then you're done, or testing. You're going to test this thing and then it goes into production. There are various activities like that where this ability to turn it on, turn it off is really attractive. That's part of it. The other big reason that I think cloud computing makes sense is when you're trying to offload the drain on your internal resources, and it starts to sound a lot like the argument or the business case for outsourcing to me. It's not that you can't do it. It's that you've got other activities that you'd rather spend your time on. Mm-hmm. And when you can find specialists who do that and they're good at it and they've got a track record, you can get a good value, why not let them do that for you? And so I think those are probably the two big driving reasons. And it seems to make sense for smaller government agencies where it's hard to get the budget to build the infrastructure and do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very attractive to them. And then the ability to scale. I think those are the two reasons that that would move a government client into that kind of an environment.
Are CIOs asking the right security questions about cloud now, do you think?
I think we've all gotten more mature about that. I think initially the concern was, you know, I can't let it out of my sight. If I don't have personal, direct, physical control of it, it can't be secure.
I call them server huggers.
And I do think we're past that. I think both the service providers and the technology providers, if you're going to build it yourself, have done a good job of getting people more comfortable with the notion that you can, in fact, secure this stuff in transit. You can secure it at rest. We all have fairly robust security practices around people for the internal threat. And then the technology is still evolving for being stronger on the defensive end of it, trying to keep external threats out. But I think the security question is much more mature discussion today.
Mm-hmm. Let's stay on the security thread for a minute, though. You mentioned internal threats versus external threats. Do you think we're, as a community, the federal government's finally coming around to the idea that internal threats may be just as debilitating, just as potentially damaging as external threats? Seems like for a long time we were focused on the bad guys, whether they were states, nation states, organized crime or whatever. But the internal threat is potentially just as bad, even at agencies. I mean, you figure at an intelligence agency, you might run a risk of having a spy in the house. But that is just as likely at an agency where you wouldn't think of someone being there.
Right. There are really two flavors of internal threat. One is accidental and one is intentional.
Mm-hmm.
The accidental threat is somebody who just does something, you know, without thinking and that's where the educational program, you just got to keep it in front of them and not let them get lax about it. Training. Those are the kinds of things you do to try to deal with the accidental threat. Intentional threats, my sense is that doesn't happen a lot, but when it happens, it's usually a really high-risk thing for the organization, and it's hard to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be diligent. But I think that's also the case with external threats. The game has really changed over the last few years. It's a lot more constant. It's a lot more sophisticated. And so, you know, security is not a part-time job. I mean, you've got to have trained professionals 24/7 worrying about these issues. And whether you're monitoring the network or you're monitoring the workforce somehow, you've got to pay attention to what's going on, looking for signs of something's not quite right, and try to deal with it before there's a negative impact. But I think that whole conversation has moved in the right direction over the last couple of years, and I think people really are starting to understand that this is part of a total picture that you've got to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as much about people as it is about technology.
So many of the points that we hit on when it comes to cybersecurity are just downers. The bad guys are getting more sophisticated, technology's more complex, so it's harder to defend, and there's a laundry list of them. Is there any good news out there when it comes to cybersecurity? Or are there things that we're getting better at faster than they're getting better at them, or anything like that?
Well, you kind of stole my words, because what came to my mind was the good news is we're getting better at
uh-huh.
it. I think certainly at our company, we've changed up our strategy over the last year and a half. If you looked at folks 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it was almost totally a defensive strategy. You're mm-hmm. trying to keep the bad guys out.
Yeah.
And that's just almost impossible to do anywhere mm-hmm. today. And so you have to move to a strategy that's both defensive and offensive. So we spend a lot more effort today on internally monitoring the network, the traffic. You've got to pay attention to patterns. So the patterns look like they've changed. You put sensors out there that detect anomalies and what's going on and where it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
We've really amped up our game on education and training. Just as we've discussed today, you just got to keep it in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
That they got to pay attention. They know where to go when they need help. They know what a problem might look like. You've got to do all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And as I look around at you know, our colleagues in industry, I look around at the folks we serve in government, everyone seems to be dealing with it that way, in that multifaceted way. And
yeah.
that just wasn't going on a few short years ago. So I think people get it. It's a real threat. It's not going away. It can have serious consequences. And it's just a cost of doing business. You've got to invest in all of those things, not some of them,
mm-hmm.
if you're going to effectively defend your infrastructure and more importantly, defend your information.
What are some of the success stories that you've seen, or whether it's at your own company or whether it's things that you've seen in government? What are some success stories, some best practices that you've seen when it comes to cybersecurity, things that maybe people don't even know are out there, options that are available?
Well, we've seen some really good sensors come on the market that are very intelligent. I think the real secret to getting your arms around these external threats is to automate as much of the process as you can. It's just too much going on, too many variations for human beings to try to detect and deal with it. So you've got to try to automate it. And so there's some real progress in automated sensors that can detect patterns, sensors that can do very deep analysis of what's embedded in the information flow coming through the network, very good tools to help contain a threat once you find it so that you can cut it off from the rest of the network. Moving toward next generation firewalls, which are much more intelligent. I think the training for the people that need to do this kind of work for you has evolved quite a bit. I would say that management awareness and support for these things has really improved over the last few years, because I think executives, and whether it's in the private sector or it's in the government, understand what the consequences are being compromised.
Yeah.
You can't stand it. So the support that you need, both in terms of resources and management priority to get these things done well, is there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are success stories for us.
All right. Let's do a little role play here for a second. I'm a CIO at an agency, and I am having a coffee with you, and I say, you know what? I agree with you on the training, and we need to keep it going, and so on. First thing that gets cut on my budget is travel. Second thing that gets cut is training. How do I demonstrate an ROI for the training money that's being spent? How do I demonstrate that this has to stay, that this is as close to non-negotiable as I can get?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first thing I would say is, this was true when I was in the government, it's true now that I'm in the private sector, is there is always pressure on the budget. So, I mean, that's just life.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be prepared to justify the value add to what you're trying to do. So you ought to expect that. That's part of the job. But I think it really boils down to being able to articulate the consequences to the enterprise if there's a compromise. And whether you're a company in the private sector or you're a government agency, I mean, there are consequences to your reputation, which affect how well you can perform your job or the support you get for resources you need to do your job. So there's the reputational things. There's the loss of information, whether that's about privacy, or it's about intellectual property, or it's about national security. Those things are all important. And you just have to be able to make a linkage between the potential for compromise to the consequence of that compromise, and then, you know, turn it into an investment. Because, I mean, that's basically what we do is, mm-hmm. you know, here's what these tools or what this training will allow us to do. This is the likelihood of this happening. This is the magnitude of the damage if it happens. And, you know, you kind of make an investment case.
You released maybe a year or so ago a list of 5 steps for successful IT project management. I'm going to read them off and see if we can expand on each of those and see if there may be some thoughts you wanted to add that maybe you've gained since you first wrote this or anything like that. First one is reach consensus on project scope. Number 2, ensure costs align with requirements. Number 3, stay disciplined. Number 4, don't ignore the elephant in the room. And number 5, keep asking yourself questions. I thought this list was really interesting when it came out because it doesn't touch on any of the traditional project management concepts that you would think about or read about in books or whatever. This is at a more conceptual level, which I think is really instructive for somebody trying to manage any kind of project in government, not just IT.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for that. I've been doing this for almost 40 years. It's hard to believe that, but so when I put this list down, I mean, it was just really kind of my summary of a lifetime of experience with trying to make programs work. And it's still surprising. I mean, this is not rocket science. I mean, I think this is all pretty common sense.
But if we look at how many IT projects go awry, I mean, it's stuff that people aren't necessarily thinking of.
Well, and I still face it every day. I mean, whether you're doing a project for a customer or you're doing a project internally for your company, you really have to make sure that these things get agreed to if you're going to have a successful program. And it's easy to skip step, but I think most of the disagreements I see are whether it's an internal customer or external customer, they're unhappy about your performance. It's almost always about one of these 5 things.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't take the time to agree on what it was you were trying to do. And, you know, I think that step applies to almost anything you do. I mean, if you're trying to decide whether you're going to outsource or not, or you're trying to decide whether you want to go to cloud computing, or you're trying to decide, in some investment you're trying to make, it's easy to just assume you're going to get the cost savings. Or you're to assume that you're going to improve performance. But those things get you to very different places.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those, you know, depending on whether cost savings or performance improvement is your objective, will get you a different solution.
Yeah.
It'll get you a different price. So, you know, you really need to get agreement on that. It seems so obvious, but I mean, it's important to do the cost thing. And I think particularly when you're in a business where, you're constantly negotiating, what you're going to do for a certain amount of money. Is the customer's got a huge role, important role there, because if you expect a Cadillac but you only have money for a Chevrolet, I mean, guess what?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so whether you're talking about your personal life or you're at work, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. These things have to align or you won't get the result you're expecting.
Mm-hmm.
So the stay disciplined. I mean, process has been very important to me personally in my career. I mean, where you're able to implement a disciplined way of doing things, it allows you to train people to that process. It allows you to measure against that process. A lot of good things happen when you have a documented way of doing things that everybody understands and you can, it's predictable and observable. Those are all good things, and yet it's very easy to just start working.
Mm-hmm.
And if you allow yourself to fall into that trap, you lose your bearings. You don't know where you're at with the program. You don't know how much you got left to do. You don't know whether you're doing it well or not. So, I mean, putting a disciplined framework around how you execute is, in my view, always worth the time and effort it takes.
I'm going to post up the article that lists these five steps at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon so people can go and check them out. Is there one of these that you see violated more often than others, especially inside government?
I think number four, the don't ignore the elephant in the room. It's the way we're built, I think, in our society is folks want to be polite. They don't want to hurt your feelings. And certainly if you're the contractor delivering the service, you don't want to have an argument with your customer. Mm-hmm. But usually these things that cause a program to fail are not hidden. They were there for a long time, and for whatever reason, folks just didn't want to acknowledge it and deal with it. Mm-hmm. And it's a little uncomfortable, but in my experience, once somebody's got the courage to just put it out there and put it on the table, people are willing to deal with it, talk about it, sort it out, figure out what you need to do to correct it. And you can save the program that way. So if you're executing a complex program, a high visibility program, something that's really key to the organization, and there's just something that's a little out of kilter, don't be afraid to talk about it, because more often than not, other folks see it too, and they were just waiting for somebody to bring it up.
What do you think about some of the project management initiatives the administration's put in place? They've done some things a lot different than what were done in the Bush administration. And I'm curious to know, what do you think of the dashboards and some of the other initiatives that are out there for people to really keep an eye on these things?
Well, and I think on balance, they've been positive. The dashboard, I think, has been a good thing because it makes an attempt to make visible how things are doing. And it attempts to create a structure to kind of compare things on a even basis. Now, some folks complain that maybe it's a little bit too much self-reporting, but still, I think it's had an overall positive effect because, you can't hide, mm-hmm. So you can argue about whether it's red or yellow or whatever, but it keeps the performance of the program in front of everybody, and mm-hmm. I think in general that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. There ought to be a natural process in place to do that anyway.
Yeah,
I think the efforts that Vivek has taken lately around portfolio management are good.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I think it sounded to folks like we were talking about going to a single solution for things. That worried me a little bit from the standpoint that I just know how hard it is to get multiple agencies lined up on a way to do anything.
Right.
But what that really has turned into is a vote for discipline program management, and I think that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's about these programs that have lived a long time, and they're off schedule, and they're off budget, and it's not clear what they're delivering anymore. Those things ought to be challenged, and if they can't be fixed, they ought to be killed. And
yeah.
So I think that's good, healthy management. I think that's been a real plus.
Is there a risk, though, of too much transparency, too many dashboards where there's so much stuff, so much information out there that even the people who need to keep track of it can't keep track of it all?
Yeah, I don't. My sense is we're not there yet.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's just the one dashboard that everybody's looking at. Now there are a lot of systems in there.
Yeah. Well, there's the one IT dashboard, but there are a lot of dashboards all over other areas too, where theoretically people who are doing management at a broader scale,
right,
are just seeing avalanches of data that they weren't seeing, 2 years ago.
Right. I guess I of course have focused on the IT dashboard, so I'm not looking at all of them. And certainly you've got to keep these management schemes relatively simple, or mm-hmm. or you do get information overload. I'd agree with you there. But I was thinking along the lines of particularly in the area of trying to get a handle on the IT programs, there's that one dashboard that everybody's looking at, and then you've got your list of the top 20 or top 40 critical programs. I for government-wide, I think that's a pretty manageable list. And so I think from that standpoint, that's practical. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's doable. It's the same question you have to ask yourself when you're trying to develop metrics for a program.
Mm-hmm.
The temptation is to measure everything you can think of.
Yeah.
And that never works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my advice to folks is always figure out the 10 or 15 things that really matter and measure those. And if that doesn't seem to steer the program where you need it to go, you can swap them out as you go. But where you see 40, 50, 100 metrics, that overwhelms everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you do need to keep these management schemes fairly straightforward and simple. But they do work. I mean, what you focus people on tends to be where you get progress.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think overall, these have been good initiatives.
If we sit down and have this conversation, say, 2 years from now or 5 years from now, and I hope it's not that long, but if we do talk about this, so many of these things regarding technology are so hard to handicap. They're so hard to predict because we just don't know where the next turn in the road is going to be or where it might take us. Is that even practical to try to figure out what a long-term goal is, or other than the really broad conceptual things, we want our networks to be safer and things like that. Is it better to think in shorter bites of time?
I think that's where I've settled. I didn't always think that way. I kind of grew up in an era of big programs and learning to do the big flow charts and map it all out and 10,000 things on the chart and all that. But no one seems to have a very good track record at making those happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so the current emphasis on chunking programs, in fact, I was in a meeting with about a dozen federal, state, and local CIOs about 10 days ago. And they all are very excited about that as a strategy to try. Now, that has its own challenges because when you chunk up big programs into small pieces, then somebody's got to take on the responsibility for maintaining what that long-term vision is, because those chunks have all got to fit into something if
mm-hmm.
you're going to get somewhere.
Yeah.
But we know how to manage smaller projects better than we do how to manage big projects. And
mm-hmm.
so doing these in bite-sized chunks, I think, work better in the culture of government. I mean, they align better with budget cycles. They align better with being able to demonstrate that you've delivered things. But it does require you to architect the solution a lot differently because this total objective you're trying to reach now has to be made functional in bite-sized pieces.
Yeah.
And that's a discipline into itself. But I think it's a way to avoid these runaway programs that just drag on for years and never really come to fruition. That's the only way I know to really get your arms around that.
We're starting to see a lot more of that happening in government, and I would love to talk with you more about that. We're also starting to run out of time, and so that will be a place that we'll have to do, as I said, hopefully not 2 years or 5 years from now, much sooner, get back together and talk about that some more.
Well, I'd like to do that. I've really enjoyed being here today.